On this week's 51%, we get personal below the belt. First, homeless women face a particular monthly challenge. Then we hear why girls should be queens of their pelvic regions.
It's a multi-billion dollar health care issue, pelvic health, anything around pelvic health.
And we have an historical look at Gal Pals. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I wish today it would rain all day. Maybe that'll kind of make the pain go away. Trying to forgive you for abandoning me. Praying, but I think I'm still an angel away. Angel away, yeah, strange in a way. Maybe that is why I chase strangers away. They got their ass out aiming at me. But I become Neo when they aiming at me. Me against them. Me against enemies. Me against friends.
Somehow being homeless means it's a daily challenge to get your basic needs met. Eating, bathing, and using the bathroom. For many women, another challenge arises each month when they get their periods. Liz Pfeffer reports for KALW's Cross Currents.
This subject is uncomfortable for some people to talk about, but not as uncomfortable as it is to live with every month. Just ask Kristen Devlin.
Oh my God, dude. And you know what? You hit me the first time because I'm totally bleeding, dude. Right,
Devlin's arms are covered in cuts and scars. When I meet her, she's reading a Jane Austen zombie novel in a homeless encampment under an Interstate 80 overpass in San Francisco. She's 31 and gets a regular period. She even has an app on her phone to track it.
It sucks, dude. Like, one of the hardest things really is like, probably gotta be just finding places to change your dude, like really. That and like, you know, washing your clothes. So hydrogen peroxide can be easually gotten. It's like hella cheap at the dollar stores and stuff, but I mean, yeah, dude, yeah. And supply.
For homeless women in San Francisco, supplies like pads and tampons aren't that hard to come by if you know where to look. Shelters are required to provide feminine hygiene products. For Devlin, her product of choice is the Diva Cup, a menstrual cup you can leave in longer than a tampon and reuse.
And it is cheaper, they're cheaper than tampons, but it's like, but they're messy.
And when you're homeless, finding a bathroom or safe place to change is tough. So when your period is messy, and they often are, it can feel like a nightmare.
While there are a lot of really wonderful services that are both open to men and women.
Kemi Roll leads street outreach services for the San Francisco Women's Community Clinic.
There are different needs for those populations. And if you can imagine a homeless woman who might be struggling with, issues of trauma, issues of violence, might be currently using, going into a male-dominated space might not be the safest space for her.
This particular outreach program provides hygiene supplies from toothpaste to tampons to between 90 and 150 homeless women a week.
But if a woman doesn't have supplies and she's living on the street, what does she do?
It can look a few different ways from, you know, doing things like makeshift supplies such as using toilet paper, even though, again, for someone who's under-resourced, having access to something like toilet paper is actually pretty significant. And oftentimes, our clients don't have anything, so they may be bleeding in their clothes.
And having soiled clothes can add to the judgment around the appearance and odor of homeless people, Roll tells me. Not only is it humiliating and damaging to a woman's self-esteem, there's also a physical health risk. And improvising with unsanitary products or leaving them in too long can lead to vaginal infections that lower the immune system.
It's not like you have something in the library that gives you a handbook, you know, how to be homeless or where to find all of these resources.
This is Anna. She asked that I not use her last name. She says she became homeless 2 years ago after being displaced from her apartment. Today, she's getting a free lunch at Martin DePore House of Hospitality. She says her first 6 months of homelessness were absolute misery.
You want to preserve your dignity as a human being, especially as a woman. There were times I would just use toilet paper. That's the only thing I could think of. It is hard, especially with nowhere to go to shower.
Have you ever discussed this with other homeless women that you know?
No. Sometimes it's almost too painful to discuss something like this. once you've gone through it. But a lot of times when a person is just getting into a situation that's really new and difficult in that way that you can't really connect with others easily and you don't know where to go for resources, there is no one centralized place.
During the day, she would hang around libraries with public restrooms so she had access to a toilet. When her food stamps kicked in, she would use them at 24-hour fast food restaurants with restrooms for paying customers. But even if you are a paying customer, many bathrooms have done away with the tampon for a quarter vending machine. But there is a growing movement pushing to make tampons and pads as available as toilet paper in all bathrooms.
A lot of the Bay Area companies offer that, and a lot of more progressive businesses do.
That's Nancy Kramer. She's been interested in this tampon problem since 1982, when she visited the Apple headquarters in Cupertino and saw something she'd never seen before: free tampons and pads in the women's restroom.
But it's absent in the airport in San Francisco. It's absent in a lot of restaurants in San Francisco. It's absent in the schools in San Francisco. So there are many places that it absolutely is not the case where those items are accessible to people when they need it.
Kramer isn't a homeless advocate. She's a women's advocate who says the menstrual cycle is a natural bodily function. She says if men got periods, we wouldn't be having this conversation. In comes Free the Tampons, an organization Kramer started that's pushing for free feminine hygiene products in every bathroom nationwide, at the expense of the business owner. That sounds expensive, but the organization has also been working to help develop timed tampon dispensers that would prevent abuse of complementary products.
We have toilet paper that takes care of the other bodily functions that we use the restroom for, but I think it's a bit of a gender equality issue.
Internationally, tampon drives, like canned food drives for people in need, are growing in popularity. Some people acknowledge that it's an overlooked basic need. But even if sanitary products become accessible to every woman, here in San Francisco, homeless women will still struggle to find safe places to use them. For Cross Currents, I'm Liz Pfeffer.
This is for all you girls about 13. High school can be so rough, can be so mean. Hold on to you.
The Chicago-based Women's Health Foundation wants to empower girls to make good, health-conscious choices and educate them about a part of their bodies often left out of the discussion in health education classes. So the foundation is out with a book entitled Below Your Belt: How to Be Queen of Your Pelvic Region, a Pelvic Health Handbook for Girls, written by Executive Director Missy Lavender and content and program developer Jennifer Donatelli-M. The book covers everything from the history of women's pelvic health to anatomy, bladder health, and pelvic exercises. Pelvic health disorders affect 1 out of 3 women in the U.S., and the Women's Health Foundation feels that addressing these issues in young girls may help improve the statistic. Their goal in creating the book is to help girls be strong from the inside out as they participate in sports, establish habits surrounding bathroom behaviors, hygiene, and nutrition, and head into young adulthood with a new understanding and connection to their pelvic region. I spoke with Jenny M. about how the book came to be.
It was really founded through the Women's Health Foundation, the work that they have been doing with bladder health. That was really our big thing. And then we realized it's so much more. Bladder health had been missed, we feel like, in so many other books and other programs. So there's just so much more around it. So then we realized when we went and did our study in the Chicago schools, which we were so excited. It just got published in the Journal of Pediatric and Adolescent Gynecology.
Oh, wow.
We were happy to see that.
Congrats.
Yeah, we were really happy about that. Thank you. But we realized as we were talking with the girls with bladder and then bowel health that there were so many more questions that they had. So then that expanded into, you know, basic anatomy. You know, what is down there? Because we joke with the girls, right? Boys, they know their anatomy from day one. It's easy to see it. And we don't know ours. And then bladder health, bowel health, which is what we've always been teaching it through Women's Health Foundation programs, and muscles. So structures and muscles, that was another thing, how to help the girls have better posture, maybe perform better in their sports. We do touch on pelvic floor muscles. We call them their pretty fabulous muscles in the book. but we touch on it really so that they have knowledge. They're there. They exist. Yes, they are around the openings of the urethra, the other openings in the bottom, and they're important for you to know that. We don't really get into the detail of exercising their pelvic floor muscles, but we want them to know that when they get older and if somebody mentions it to them, that they'll have some awareness around this part of their body and why it's important, you know, to take good care of your body for the long term.
And tell me again the name of the study that was just published. That's really important.
It's called A Pelvic Health Curriculum in School Settings, The Effect on Adolescent Female Knowledge.
Now, I wanted to just go back to the bladder health. Could you mention a few things within that? Because I really want people to have a concrete idea of, you know, some issues here.
Sure. So we teach them what we'd like to call basically potty training 101, the basics. So sitting all the way down, we have found, is a really big issue for women and girls. Everybody wants to hover over the toilet seat because they're so dirty. So we just say, you know, if you want to keep it neat, build a seat, put toilet paper around. But it's the importance of sitting down and relaxing those pelvic floor muscles. It's so important to just, first of all, empty the bladder fully. And second of all, to relax. We kind of rush through urination. Even little girls rush through it. And we want them to understand not to push it out. That's key. Because they force it out to go faster.
What's wrong with that?
Well, because it can put unnecessary strain on those pretty fabulous muscles down there. Mm. And over time, if that continues for some women, that can cause urinary leakage. We like to say light bladder leakage, stress incontinence when you laugh, cough, sneeze, or jump. We found that some of our girls have some of those issues already at a young age. And that can lead to a whole other quality of life, right?
Of course.
Used to love running, but now you wet your pants, so now you stop. And now that just spirals into so many other health issues.
Sure, domino effect, right? It's
exactly.
Really interesting, Jenny, what you said about urination, because, you know, I wonder if it's partially, you know, just we're not really taught correctly, as you're talking about now, and also just the society. As we get older, to even find a minute to run down the hall at work, right, and urinate, you're just thinking about, oh, my gosh, I have to go answer 10,000 emails, and I have this and that, and you do rush through it. And then there is the cleanliness aspect, because I certainly fall into that camp, and I'm not a fan of public restrooms. I don't know who is, but I really avoid them at all costs, but sometimes one has to use one. So I definitely fall into that category. I don't think I could relax in a public restroom.
Well, and that's what we're trying to do, is teach the girls at such a young age. We say, take 2 minutes and actually enjoy this moment. Like, we joke about it, and they think it's funny, too. But we're like, this is your time. This is your time alone. We want you to sit and relax. And the other part we teach is this called just in case peeing. So we teach little girls at a very young age, and I'm guilty of it, too, with my daughters. We teach them, you have to go potty because we're getting in the car. You have to go potty because we're going to the park. And, of course, that's natural and normal when a child is being potty trained, because that's what you have to do. But then that sometimes carries over, and then this just-in-case peeing becomes a bigger issue as they become adults. Mm-hmm. And now you're always looking for the bathroom because you actually have some type of urge incontinence where you got to go all the time. Mm-hmm. So that's another one we talk about in the book.
Thanks. Yeah, that's really helpful. I just wanted to get more of an idea. But go on. There were some other things you were kind of listing.
Oh, and really just the drinking the water. I mean, we know a lot of our young girls are drinking, I don't even know some of the stuff they're drinking these days, blue juice and some of the other bladder irritants. So if they're experiencing some type of urge or stress incontinence, we want them to know that water is just the best thing for them. We don't, you know, we're not trying to say don't drink that, but if you are having these issues, of course, talk to your healthcare provider. And then second, make sure that you're drinking water.
Wait, so are you saying some of these, I don't, you know, there's so many infused beverages these days, right? And energy drinks and all of that. Are there some ingredients in there that are irritants? Is that it?
Yes. Caffeine for sure, and carbonation, we know, are definite. And then if you add a diet soda to it, the aspartame, so those, we call that the triple whammy. That can definitely irritate the bladder more so. And everybody's different. For someone, it could be completely fine. Some people may not realize that's what's causing this trigger for themselves.
Okay, so what else do we have below the belt?
So what else do we have in the book specifically?
Yes.
So yes, the hygiene. We talk about hygiene. That was a big one that we discovered when we were working with the girls in the schools. There's a lot of shame and taboo that there are feelings about around the below the belt, you know, and odor in particular, and girls using sprays and not realizing that that's just causing, again, a whole nother issue of pelvic health issues. So hygiene is really important to teach our young girls, you know, just clean water, a non-irritating soap, if even from, you know, just water and maybe even a washcloth is fine. And even the moms, I've had some moms, you know, say, oh yeah, you know, my daughter has odor or something. I'm like, but that's normal. That's natural. It's important we're teaching them to understand the natural odor that they have in case something does change. Now we have an issue. Now we need to see someone and get help.
Okay. So that, yeah, I can imagine that's an uncomfortable conversation to have with someone that age.
Right.
Or even someone this age.
I was going to say, it's even more uncomfortable, I think, for the grown-ups sometimes, where the girls kind of get it. They're like, oh, so this is normal. That's great. I'm glad to know that. I don't need to spray, and I don't need to do this. But yes, you have to take, you know, regular baths or showers. That's the goal, right, around this age. And, you know, wearing cotton underpants to help with odor and with yeast infections can be very helpful. So all these kind of basics that we've learned to navigate along the way after we've had problems, right?
Well, you learn from experience, so that's just how it is in life. You know, that's how we go. So what age group is this aimed at?
It's really aimed at age 10 to 14. But I will say that the goal is also to reach the caregiver, whether it's mom, grandma, it could even be dad, to have these open conversations with the child. And I've had some moms say, oh gosh, you know, my daughter needs this sooner. And I've had some moms say, oh, I don't think my daughter's ready for that. So I think it's best that the caregiver reads it first or with the daughter, and then they can decide what's the best age to start.
We're not going to argue that the subject is not taboo, and that's a shame, but it is. Do you find that there is more or less awareness with girls in this age group these days?
What I find is that they're very open. They're not afraid, they're not ashamed, and they're willing to share. And I find that refreshing, you know, because sometimes I'll even go in with a colleague who's newer and she'll say, okay, how are we going to do this? And I'm like, don't worry, they're gonna really participate because they want this information.
So, you know, I'm curious, when you're teaching this in the school environment, is it only girls? Is the classroom gender specific?
It is only girls. It's only geared toward girls. And that is one challenge without question we have in the public school system, or even we were able to teach at one school that was all girls, which of course made it so easy. That was part of this whole creation of the book too. How do we reach as many girls as possible? Because pulling girls out of school just for one class can be challenging. Ideally, we would love to see it inserted into some type of health curriculum.
You have so much going on, you know, with this out and with the study just being published and just teaching and getting the word out and informing. But what's next? Where do you go from here?
That's a really good question, too. You know, I think there's a lot of things that we've been thinking about, maybe even moving to the college level for girls and kind of working with them. Probably, I'd say the other part would be mother-daughter workshops and having this, fostering these more of these conversations, so that it's a more open and acceptable conversation to have, because it's a multi-billion dollar health care issue, pelvic health, anything around pelvic health. So when you think about just some basic pelvic health, like I said, UTIs and yeast infections and constipation, that really wreaks havoc on our healthcare system. So that would also be one of these major goals, is here we are trying to do prevention here. And we're trying also to give women and girls this information and arm them with valuable information, number one, to hopefully prevent other problems from happening and to get to care sooner and faster.
That was Jennifer Donatelli-Im of the Women's Health Foundation and co-author of Below Your Belt, How to Be Queen of Your Pelvic Region, a Pelvic Health Handbook for Girls. Well, thanks to Taylor Swift, 2015 will be remembered as the year we all wanted to be part of the squad, Taylor's ever-growing group of friends, pop music's biggest star, who used to be all about boyfriends, is now all about her girlfriends. A Virginia historian says there was another time in history when gal pals were having a real moment. Lilia Fukin has the story.
In the late 1600s, Great Britain started to expand rapidly. Colonists traveled across oceans and seas to start new lives on distant shores. Amanda Herbert, an historian at Christopher Newport University, says that all this expansion had people really worried. They feared what it might do to the very fabric of their society.
They had relied upon face-to-face interactions in order to create contracts, to pass laws, to wage wars even, to start businesses. And they were concerned that without these face-to-face interactions, British society would crumble.
Fortunately, the greatest thinkers of the time, philosophers, theologians, intellectuals, believed there was a solution.
The solution to those challenges lay in women's social networks.
Herbert says this idea that women's sociability would save society was deeply rooted in medicine, and medicine at the time was based on the four humors.
Black bile, phlegm, yellow bile, and blood.
Because women had more black bile and phlegm, they were colder and wetter, which, stay with me here, meant that they were more emotional and better at friendships.
They'd be able to cultivate friends, keep friends, and form emotionally significant bonds.
With so much riding on the female social network, the 18th century saw an explosion of manuals and pamphlets detailing exactly how women should maintain their friendships.
They expected women to write letters to one another across the Atlantic and across the Irish Sea. They expected them to exchange recipes. They expected them to provide health care or advice about health care, how to stay well in a lot of these environments where people were very frequently growing sick. They expected them to provide religious advice and solace to people who were suffering or who were uncertain about where their future was going to head as they started their colonial lives.
Which is to say that even back in the 1600s and 1700s, women were being nagged about whether they remembered to write to their Aunt Judy or send a baby gift. But Herbert says there is evidence that some of these hyper-involved women's friendships did help the colonists.
There's an example that I have of a woman who was in North Carolina, and she had traveled there as part of the early immigration movement. And when she got there, she was devastated and lonely. She wrote to her female friends once they were finally settled in North Carolina, and she said, "I've just been distraught since I arrived." And then almost immediately, 2 days later, she sent another letter. And she said, "I sent a letter 2 days ago, and I know you haven't gotten it yet, but I wanted to let you know that yesterday I got my first letter from my family back home." And she said it had totally changed her perspective on her colonial experience. She said, "Our business now goes on with strength." So just one piece of news, one exchange of information about how family members were doing, she was able to say that she could now establish a life in the colonies.
Herbert says that the more she learns about this period when female friendships were spotlighted, the more she sees similarities to present day. While science has advanced beyond the four humors, she believes social networking hasn't. Women, she argues, are still expected to be more communicative, friendly, and open.
It's expected that this is just how women are. I'm putting massive air quotes around that. Instead, I would say that this is culturally constructed, that these are a series of messages that we send to young girls in our society today. We expect them to be friendly and kind towards one another. And then when we don't see that happening, there's a lot of hand-wringing about what that might mean for society as a whole.
So the good news, Herbert believes, is that some mean girl behavior might not be as destructive as many fear or as unnatural. For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Lilia Fukin.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at WAMC.org and follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1374.